TCJ Radio International presents Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Well, the Coffeehouse Church was actually an event where people were gathering every Thursday evening from 7 to 10 o'clock at night. A different mix of people who had had all different crisis situations in their life, either divorce, separation, burnout syndrome, or they were unemployed. And they were beginning to reflect their life in a more existential way than they have a chance to do it in a worship service on a Sunday morning. It was a sharing and encouraging atmosphere. Today we would call this kind of an empowerment.
But at the time, back in the 70s, I assume, I can imagine, this raised a few eyebrows, perhaps also among your colleagues.
Yes, of course. I was wise enough to declare this is something we are doing on a Thursday evening and not on a Sunday as a special service during the week, which was no competition to the traditional church. And I managed to get both institutional churches, the Protestant and the Roman Catholic, to support this project because they said, you reach people which we do not reach anymore.
So this was an ecumenical function then?
It was very ecumenical, and we had atheists, we had members who hadn't seen a church for 20 years, but realized there they are touching on that what concerns me as we think of Paul Tillich, the German theologian in exile in the United States, who said, die Grenze ist der fruchtbare Ort der Erkenntnis.
The borderline areas is fruitful ground.
Is fruitful ground to grow.
You were a kind of one-man halfway house in the sense that you were trying to help religion come alive and to feel immediacy on the part of these individuals, to help them identify with living religion. Is that a fair assumption?
I think it's more than a fair assumption. It's when you begin to discover in day-to-day problems different levels, then you can say, for instance, language is life. And then you begin to see, oh, what is monologue? What is dialogue? What does it mean to speak? What does it mean to be silent?
So many people talk but don't listen today.
That's right. Yeah. And so in this sense, they discovered themselves and we each other, and then we had special courses to deal with theological questions which you were not allowed to ask in the parish. You could question everything, and that brought to life and to light many problems which they had, which they hadn't been able to work through. Maybe they were just lost with images from Virgin Mary and didn't dare question what does that really mean. And that was an emphasis for those who wanted to go deeper.
People who were asking the question, why, and asking for substantiation about so much dogma, perhaps certainly it applies to all of Christianity, but the implication is that Roman Catholics may have been particularly troubled by some of this dogma.
Well, in a way, how should I express it? There is a holiness to day-to-day living, which maybe the Catholics have a closer approach. Because, I mean, in a traditional Catholic environment, you go as you are to the Mass. In the morning, it's like a day-to-day structure. And you get maybe some insight just in being quiet, listening to a priest. But they go out of their home to meet others, and this we lost. We don't have that in the Protestant. You are on your own, and you have to discover your own spirituality if you ever find out what it's all about.
And this is where a one-on-one relationship is so important. You tailor-make your answers to their needs, right. Not in the sense of telling them what they want to hear,
no.
But helping them to ask the right questions and help them search for the answers.
Exactly. And that's why we had different things we were offering besides the Thursday evening. We had weekends, we had courses. And also some of them said, listen, I want to offer my service, my talents, and come with you to the prison. Because at the same time, I was prison chaplain, And we had a gathering once a month with these lay people, professional people, within the prison. And that was most exciting, not only for them or for the inmates. There was some fresh air coming from the outside. And this experience is going on in that same penitentiary, taken over by others. But we were allowed to come with 20 to 25 people, sitting down with also coffee and cake, and talk over the situation. What does it mean to be convicted for 10 or 12 years and to live with this, no contact to the family, or having, again, divorces happening while in prison? And they could express problems which they couldn't talk with fellow inmates. It was too intimate.
How many people came to the average coffee house church meeting?
Well, in the high days, there were maybe 40 to 50 every Thursday evening, and they came maybe twice a month. So in a way, how do you count that? I would say there were hundreds of people, there were thousands of people over those 20 years who got a different idea what life could be and the meaning, but not in preaching, not in having to start with a biblical text, but with their reality, and then searching with others, hey, there may be a track which could lead me to a new path.
Ironically, under the conditions you've described, you want to end with the biblical text,
yes,
not to begin with it, because as people say today, it's more of a turnoff for this kind of person, isn't it? They're looking for something else.
Of course, one of the criteria now within the church has become the authenticity. And they want to know, do you really believe what you say? And so you have to be authentic in relationship, how you speak with them, how you deal with them, and whether you try to pretend you know the answers and they don't know it. You can't cry with them. They want you to stand and to be a counterpart. And that's why I spent some time in monasteries to find my roots again, discover the Psalms and all the power which comes through messages which I needed for myself.
Now, you're a Protestant pastor, but you did have a lot of contacts with Catholicism. And you actually, as you say, you participated and lived it with the monks together.
I spent 3 weeks in a monastery and was singing along the Gregorian chant. And I realized that within the Catholic Church, they have the different orders of the Franciscans, of the Benedictines, and they have a more authentic spirituality than the traditional churches, where they have a liturgy which is almost caught in certain phrases, which you experience much differently. Of course, I did in the monastery.
More of a personal, spiritual experience.
Yeah, and I was challenged to be in a small cell without radio, without television, without newspapers for 3 weeks, and realize, who am I in all this? And that was a great experience.
Well, all of these great discoveries happen in silence, don't they? That's the whole idea.
That's indeed. And, of course, I had one of the monks who was... I could speak with once a week. He was a professor of philosophy who was 58, went into the monastery. So it was for me a big challenge to talk to him about my life, and he understood me immediately, much quicker than many others who have no idea how to interpret life.
Of all those hundreds of people you met in the course of your work with the Coffee House Church, do you have any idea how many you were able to help, quote unquote, help?
Of course, I think I did have my share, but since it was a group relationship with always 10 or 12 people present every evening, like a net, to listen what's going on, and they could take on and say, oh, your husband has a relationship with another woman. Listen, I had the same experience. We can talk about it. So there was much self-help among people who I had trained to were able to listen, pick them up, and to see I'm not alone in this experience.
What was it like being a prison chaplain?
Well, I prison chaplain for 20 years. I made the count. I met over 8,000 people in very intensive meetings, discussions, and I had to learn a lot how to encounter people who had prison terms from 4 to 12 or 15 years. What do you say to a man in such a situation? There you have to be very careful not to talk too quickly, because first he wants to see whether you really can listen to a situation before a healing process can begin.
This must be for any serious, dedicated pastor or theologian a real trial, going into, as it were, the lion's den, where you're surrounded by everything that we try to avoid or work against: negativism, cynicism, skepticism, and you have to face this all the time. One could conclude it was a pretty thankless job.
Yes, but of course it was there, and I look at it now, interpreting what I did for 20 years. When I ask myself, why did you go into this work? Probably I wanted to find out, does this gospel of Jesus Christ, in which I believe in deeply, has any meaning even in such rotten situations? It was a test of my faith, but also of the institution and the church. Do we have anything to say and to give to people in such extremely hard situations?
Did you have something to give?
I had to learn that it's not so important what I say, but after we left each other in my cell, to help him to have some ways to go on. So I confronted him with some text out of the Psalms, and in a very vernacular language. And then they asked me, listen, where'd you get that sentence? It's not mine, it's an old prayer 3,000 years ago. And then they perhaps very shyly asked me, can you show me where it is? And I noticed it's very important to give them something for the next day to live on. If they have nothing to live on which goes beyond our dialogue we had, then it's a fire which is being extinguished 5 minutes later. And to support them, to give them food for thought, that was most exciting.
Once you had the trust built up, the bond there between you and these prisoners, did you feel appreciated in the end? Did you feel as though you were actually getting their attention and getting a message through?
I think I did. It took time, but it was growing, because I always told the prisoners, listen, and mainly to the personnel, they have been convicted by a secular trial, and there you come and you can be inspired by Jesus of Nazareth to take persons just the way they are, independent of what they have done or what their future is. And I think it's one of the most challenging job for a theologian and a pastor.
Well, you said it yourself, certainly strongly hinted at it. This was no ivory tower theology. This was hands-on, and it was as big a trial and tribulation for you and a test of your own faith and conviction as it was for these prisoners.
You said it. I didn't have a crisis in the sense that I began to think, is it worth it? I was convinced that if I can manage to live the presence of this gospel, supported by this Nazarene spirit, I was convinced it will work. This means this power is much greater than what I can ever do by myself. And many times when I arrived there with my car, I looked at the jail and said, Lord, what in the world am I going to do here? but if through me something can happen, let's to go and do it. And that was almost a very simple way. But to be sure, it's not me who changes things. It's through me that even the spirit can enter such a closed world.
You were the catalyst then.
In a way,
the medium.
Yes, I could be. And there were days where I was very happy. I had the feeling today it really happened. And there were other days where I was frustrated and said I didn't succeed, or I wasn't sensitive enough, or honest enough to confront him harder when he was always claiming that he didn't have anything wrong, but everybody else, the world is against him. And I realized I had to be more direct in confronting him, to face him and his past, than simply saying you're a poor guy, because he doesn't need to have me tell him how poor he is. I have to challenge him, what do you do next?
So really, when you think about it, there isn't an awful lot of difference then in the concept and need between the coffee house church and the prison inmates, except, of course, the one is very draconian. They're put in there against their will. The others came by their own volition. But still, the issues were fundamentally the same.
Yes, I think if you manage to let closeness happen between people without condemnation, but accepting the person independent of what he went through, and that it's not simply with many words, but you look at each other, there's a lot of eye contact where you can say, I understand you. And then,
and they feel if you do, they see it.
And within seconds, they look at you and they put their thumb up or down and tell the others, don't go to that guy. He's a lousy guy. He's not a good pastor. Or on the other side, they make propaganda, said you have to go, whether he's Turk or Lebanese. And of course, I met people from all religions, from Islam mostly. And my thing was not to convert them, because I knew they would be expelled. And I said, I can bring you a Quran, and you tell me what's important in your religion, and tell you what's important in mine. And that brought some most interesting exchange. And he rediscovered his faith, because if it would be a superficial conversion in a country where there's no chance to be a Christian, I want to strengthen him in his belief. And they accepted that completely. We discovered the core of our religion and how we live it. And of course, these were long relationships, and with the Swiss, which have been there for a long time. I still meet some of them. One who has been there 30 years in jail, I met him last week. He's out. And he's surviving and doing an extremely good job. And that's very gratifying to discover some of those inmates who have become my friends.
Another aspect of living religion, and that is your concern for a particular group of refugees who are going back to their home country, Albania. How did this begin, and what are you doing there specifically?
Well, in my last years in the prison, I was in Zurich meeting many young Albanians between 15 to 25 who were a few days before they were being expelled, returned by the police to Tirana, the capital of Albania, having been in Switzerland 2 or 3 months, partly in prison.
Economic refugees.
And they had
refugees.
No chance, because there was no war after 90 in Albania. So there had no chance to be recognized as refugees. So, of course, how do you survive when you come here? They were distributing small quantities of drugs for the big dealers and earned a little money, and thought, this is my future. But their reason to come here was to support their family. And when they were expelled, coming home, the family said, it's nice to see you, but actually we meant you to send us money to get out of our misery and poverty. So it was a very dramatic situation for thousands of young people coming here. They were caught by the police. And then after my retirement, I decided I will come and visit your country someday, because they were so frustrated to be repatriated, said, but I will come someday. And I had to eat my words and go there. And Then we began to encourage them to find a work contract in their village or little town, say, tell the boss that we from the Swiss program, HEX, which is Swiss Protestant Church Aid, we will support your employment for the first 9 months, subsidize it for 60%, so your employer has to pay only 40%. And if you can agree to work for 9 months with him, you come both to our office. And at the beginning, they were very suspicious because you said you have expelled us, you brought us to court, you come to Albania to help us, we don't believe you, you're part of the secret police. And once we could convince them, no, we have nothing to do, it's a church-directed project, we are here in Albania to find your roots and your future. It began with 5-10 contracts, and Germany and England have joined us to repatriate their Albanians through our office in Tirana, and that's a wonderful experience.
I mustn't forget here that Mother Teresa was Albanian.
Mother Teresa was Albanian, and she is very important for the Albanians. And one of these young returnees told me, do you know what Mother Teresa said? You pretend, Patrice, that it's just a few drops which are helping. But don't forget, Mother Teresa said, the ocean also is only made up of many, many drops.
Now, you've been able to help actively in this way about 500. You're coming up to the 500th as we're speaking. How many more of these cases do you have to deal with?
We could involve a few thousands of these people. At the moment, our funds are limited, but in Albania, our program is so well known that we'll have hundreds waiting to enter our program. So we are confident that maybe someday the Albanian government will also take part in supporting this program, because after all, it's their young people we are trying to support in their home country.
You're proving, Patrice de Metral, that religion lives. This is the practical living application of all the theology. But some people are concerned about the survival and the role even today of the edifice, the structure, the institution of the church. More and more people, certainly in Switzerland, are leaving the church officially. People are saying, for what? The church has outlived its usefulness. What can you say to these people?
I think it's being recognized when the church is really reaching out very concretely in different projects, like the chapel at the airport, the chapel in the main station, railway station. When you develop projects which are closer to the reality of people, then they are willing to accept. Not through sermons, but through a living presence. They realize, hey, maybe we have gone to India before, we discovered all kinds of things. But they rediscover maybe a type of Christianity which is not only preached, but lived. And there I'm confident that the message are coming through. The church indeed is trying, and partly very successfully with some new projects, but these are always minorities. And reform of a church doesn't happen in the central institution, always at the fringe. And in living this Christian gospel in existential projects which they feel that concerns me directly, I think there may be a future. And we can learn, of course, also from the third world how they're doing it, because we have intellectualized our faith, and there we have to find a new approach. As a church historian, I'm somewhat confident the message is so strong, even at the moment, it's losing the institution, it's losing members. But it's like a fire which is not burning strong, but it's glowing, you know? And I'm convinced that there are winds coming from all different directions which bring to life again, partly at some four corners of this institution, what was really meant with this gospel of Jesus Christ, and I'm not pessimistic about the future.
I think of a famous saying from the Woodstock Festival of the 60s. Oh. There's a little bit of paradise in every disaster area. Today we have unemployment. We have so many social problems. Perhaps this is the kind of thing that sensitizes people to the religious message. It becomes more relevant to them.
I think that we have to mention too. My wife was director of a project for both churches, Protestant and Catholic, for reintegrating and supporting the unemployed, not immediately with getting new job, but with facing the new reality and supporting them mentally to prepare them to look again, how could I reclassify myself in this context? And I think if you look at the prisons, at the hospitals, at the different chapel projects, at the presence of the church in different areas, it looks marginal. It's not representative, but I think it's very significant for the future. And they have to learn to sell what they're doing and believing what is good. Don't put your light under a shed, show it. And that's what we are trying to do with this new program.
What made you become a pastor?
Well, if you want to go, that was really in the United States. I was studying economics, working in an A&P at night from 10 o'clock to 4 in the morning. And we were unloading deep frozen food for the different stores in a warehouse with 10 maybe degree Fahrenheit. It was very cold, and there I developed the kind of food for thought. And again, with the experience with these workers downtown Detroit and downtown Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, I went through some very, very hard experience. I was discovering what life's all about, and that pushed me to search more. And it was not a big lightning storm like for Luther. It was more a curiosity to discover what could be the meaning of it. And then I met the Swiss professor, which was quite critical. He said, "You study economics, we need solid theologians." Then I must say the university boards were very generous to take me and say, "You studied economics, now you want to study theology. You don't have the most ideal background, but we give you a chance. If you have the average, we take you, or you drop out." And finally, I learned my Hebrew and my Greek, knowing that someday it might be useful to show my transcripts in Switzerland.
And my final personal question to you, which I always wanted to ask you, I never got a chance. Let me take the opportunity. How does a man with a very French name, Patrice de Metral, wind up in the bastion of German-speaking Switzerland, Zurich?
I can explain you. My parents, which are from the French part, came to Zurich in 1930 and established here. I was born here. And my mentality was, of course, that of a Swiss German. Through my army experience as an officer, I was in all parts, in the French, Italian part. So I became multilingual quicker than others, speaking French with my parents in German. And I love this city of Zurich, which is a small version of an American city. That's what Americans tell me.
They call it the little big city here.
The little big city. There is a fantastic program in culture, be it radio, be it television, be it concerts, being movies, and we are at the heart of life. But of course, other theologians, I smile at the values of this society, which is very money and shareholder oriented. But even that has reached its top, I think, and all the crisis in these companies maybe brings us back to more central values.
The Reverend Dr. Patrice de Metral, the hands-on pastor from Zurich, who's been involved over the years with a coffee house church, as a prison chaplain in the repatriation of Albanian refugees, always looking for a way to show that religion is still alive and well, and in his case, living near Zurich. Thank you so much indeed. For Switzerland in Sound, from Zurich, this is Bob Zanotti.
You were just listening to Switzerland in Sound with Bob Zanotti. For more information, go to www.switzerlandinsound.com.